This is the Gulf Coast Life Book Club. I'm your host, Carrie Barber. In Victor Soutamenant's debut novel, Hollow Spaces, attorney John Lowe is the only Asian-American partner in a prestigious New York City law firm. When the associate he's having an affair with is murdered, John is accused and tried for the crime. It tears apart his family, even after he's found not guilty. 30 years later, his grown children get together to try to solve the murder. Hollow Spaces is suspenseful and full of nuanced observations and crisp writing. I'm thrilled to talk with author Victor Soutamenant about it. Victor, welcome to the Gulf Coast Life Book Club.
Thank you. Thank you. Happy to be here.
This novel has a really complex structure. There's the past, I think of them as like railroad tracks. There's the past track, there's the present track, and then there's John's court case, which is almost a third track. How did you do that? How did you manage to keep all that straight and to weave it together? Was it hard to keep them straight?
Yeah, that was a very difficult part of writing the book. Initially, I started writing it the way it is on the page, where the two timelines are interwoven. And that got very complicated because I did not know the answer to the central mystery as to, you know, whether John did it and whether we would ever tell the reader. And so what ended up happening is I ended up breaking it apart and writing John's story first, and then the children's story 30 years later second, and then went back and kind of interwove them after the fact. And so, fun trivia bit is I wrote probably 90% of the novel, including John's full story, without knowing whether or not he had, you know, done the actual crime at the center of the story.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing. So you're obviously not an outliner.
I usually don't outline until the end.
Just to
figure out how I'm going to bring it home. So usually I'll outline like the last five chapters or so. But I will say that putting them together, because I followed certain, I kept the arcs of each story kind of similar.
Yeah.
And so the emotional beats and the plot beats all kind of lined up. So it made it putting them together, I think, a little easier for me.
Yes. Yeah. They are very similar. And we'll get to that in a minute. But I also want to talk about John's race is really an important part of this story. He experiences a lot of casual racism. His partners at the law firm treat him differently. People are kind of surprised that he was having an affair with this woman. Jessica is her name, the victim, and a million other things. Tell me why it was important to make his race integral to the story.
I really wanted to write a story that was about race and not about race at the same time. And I'll explain that by saying at its core, the story here could happen to any American family, right? Regardless of race. And what I wanted to do is then take something like that, you know, your legal mystery or legal thriller or family story, because I think that it's all of these things, you know, elements of literary fiction in there, and make it about an Asian American family in a way that was very specific to that experience, but could happen to any family, regardless of color. And so there was that. But I was thinking about my father's story. My father's Asian and my mother's white, and stories he had told me about their relationship when they were together, and things he had heard or were said to him. And I also talked to Asian American lawyers who had practiced, you know, 10 or more years before I started practicing law, and some of the stories they told me. And so all of those things made their way into the book.
One thing I really noticed is kind of how lonely John is. And I assume that's part of the racism. Like when he loses his job, he doesn't have really anyone to call who will. I feel like the other partners in his firm, if the same thing had happened to them, they would have like a guy to meet at the club to have lunch with who would like get them their job back or something like that. It just seemed like he just seemed so isolated. Is that part of the racist story and just how isolated he was in the firm as well as in the culture? Or am I reading that wrong?
No, I don't think you're reading it wrong. I think, again, to the extent I was, John's loneliness, I think, comes from two places. One is looking at my father and my perception of him as I was growing up and even as an adult, where, you know, some of it was the way I think masculinity and manhood was defined generally in American society at the time, but also specifically in, you know, his Asian-ness in some ways affected that. And so, yeah, I think that that is definitely part of it. And even for myself, you know, some of those expectations seep down. And for me, I looked at that story and internalizing it and thought about all the different ways. What if I wasn't blessed with, then, you know, all of these friends I have, which is wonderful, and things like that. Like, how, because even with all these friends and on all, and I've lived a great life, but it, you still feel lonely. And I think that part's universal, right? No matter how many people you have surrounding you, no matter how great your family is, there are times all of us feel alone. And what if that was always the feeling we had, and that really stuck with me?
Yes, interesting. And also, just kind of dovetailing off that, John seems to be very much influenced by other people's expectations of him, maybe more than other characters. Did you want that to be integral to his character?
Yes. I think there is a place where, and this maybe less than my father, more me, but there is always part of you that or me, I'll just make it personal. Where you, for me, a big motivating factor in my life has always been, I think, in some ways, this chip on my shoulder about either exceeding people's expectations or not complying with them. And that, I think, makes its way into John's story in that, you know, he views himself as having a very specific role in society as a lawyer and in his family as a husband and a father. And when he cannot meet his own expectations, you know, and some of these are self-imposed, right? Even,
yeah.
To the extent that you feel societal pressure or cultural pressure, really it's a choice to continue to subscribe to those pressures, right? And you just never can he can unsubscribe from them, right? So it's this trap.
Yeah. Oh, that's so interesting. Okay, so back to the siblings, John's children, a brother and sister who are alike, yet they wish they weren't. Like, they're trying to distance themselves from each other as adults. Can you say a little bit about that? What's behind that?
Yeah, I have, you know, three brothers. I have two sons. My wife has a brother. You know, I know plenty of people with siblings. I think the sibling relationship dynamic is always interesting and very dramatic. And if you throw a unsolved murder that their father was accused of on top of that, it just makes a really great, I think, way to draw some of the underlying issues everybody faces with a sibling or even a really good friend. And I really wanted to dive into that a little bit about what if you had two people who had basically the same upbringing and experience turn out two totally different ways. And I think a lot of people see that in their families, right? And so I wanted to kind of dive into that and explore a bit.
Yeah, it's such rich territory, I think, writing about siblings. Brennan is a lawyer. Brennan is the sister. She's a lawyer. Hunter is a journalist, which I thought were great jobs for them because they both are seeking the truth. And they grew up with this mystery in their family, and they're trying not to repeat their parents' behavior, but they seem destined to repeat their parents' behavior, which I think is a little bit of what you were talking about, the arcs of the story before. Can you address that a little bit?
Yeah, of course. I found it to be interesting, and it was one of the driving things about why I wanted to write this book, is this idea of what do we inherit from our parents, you know, spiritually, emotionally, behavior-wise. And sometimes, especially when people, even when they're aware, you know, you end up repeating the things you learned from your parents or carrying them forward. And I really wanted to write about that struggle. The other thing I wanted to address there is they had the same upbringing and they came out very differently. And sometimes that the other part of this is not necessarily the parents and the way you were raised, but who you are innately. You know, Brennan and Hunter have a very similar, and this is in the book, you know, experiences children with their father, and they each interpret it two different ways. And some of that is not just John and his feelings or strengths as a father, but also their, you know, feelings and strengths as individuals. And I really wanted to kind of, like I said, explore that and show how that played out.
Yes. If you're just tuning in, we're talking to Victor Sutamanant, author of a wonderful and suspenseful debut novel called Hollow Spaces. So I'm not giving any spoilers because I just checked, it's in the second line of the cover copy. So that John is acquitted of the crime, but he still can't get a job. People kind of gawk at him in public. He basically loses everything after that trial, even though he wasn't even found guilty. So can you talk about why you wanted to? I know you said you are a practicing attorney. So this is your educational background and possibly your day-to-day background. I don't know if you're a litigator or what kind of law you're practicing when you wrote this, but talk about why you wanted to write about how people are affected by a not guilty verdict.
So to answer your question, I am a litigator. I spent 10 years working for the government in a civil enforcement capacity at the United States Securities and Exchange Commission. I think as someone who would try to find the truth and you know, have to go after people who we think violated the law, your biggest fear is that you get it wrong. And it's a huge responsibility to have as a government lawyer when you bring that kind of accusation on a person to get it right. But, you know, I wanted to go from the point of view of an acquittal for two reasons. One is when you look at the typical legal drama, they end with the verdict typically as a, well, here's the truth. This is what the jury found. Any episode, for example, Law and Order tries to get to the verdict. And I think sometimes Law and Order handles it very interestingly. But the idea of an acquittal is both a great and a terrible thing, right? Because it means the system worked. You know, we have a system set up so that the jury should acquit if the government doesn't meet its burden of proof. But that means somebody was either guilty of a crime and went free, or was innocent and accused of a crime they didn't commit. And there's a lot of interesting points there. And it's not just, you know, the legal system, but I also address here, you know, the court of public opinion. Like you said, people gawk at them and people have their opinions based regardless of what happened in court. And I just think there's something to be thought of about what due process means when we think about both the legal system and the court of public opinion and all of these different ways that an acquittal or even the accusation of a crime can really affect someone's life.
Right. It really made me think twice about, you know, the assumptions I automatically make about people who are even just accused, you know, and then it's, you kind of, you know, you don't really learn all the facts. And then years later, you know, it's those of us who are just kind of reading about it in the paper don't really know what's going on behind the scenes. And it just was very, I thought you did a really beautiful job of that. It made me think a lot about my own assumptions. Inside the Mystery is also a story about marriage. Did you come into this project thinking you wanted to write about marriage?
That is a great question. Trying to decide whether I should send a link to the, you know, have my wife listen to this, but we're not. No, I kid. I did in some ways. I thought... Like I said, I approached the book really from being a father and a son.
Yeah.
And part of being both of those things, I suppose, is my own marriage and thinking about, I've been married for, I mean, now almost 20 years. And, you know, you have these ideas of what marriage is when you are young and you start, you know, you get married. And then after 20 years, those ideas kind of can change or shift as you and your spouse grow. And so I did want to address kind of this idea, and it goes back to the thing I was talking about earlier, is no matter how great everything around you is, including your spouse, there are times you feel really lonely. And how do you handle that or manage that in a marriage? And I think some people handle it well and some people don't. Mm-hmm. And I tried to imagine a scenario in which, you know, what if I made every bad choice that was available to me in times when, you know, every marriage has tension, and what would that be like? And get at the truth of the underlying emotions. And for John's story, I think it's just, I wanted to write about, separate from me now, but I thought the idea of an affair kind of predicated in this idea of, I wanted to get really at the root and the truth of why one person, John, in this instance, might have an affair that was actually rooted in his love for his wife, you know? And I thought that was an interesting thing to try to capture. So I tried to do it.
Yeah, it is a really interesting portrait of a marriage. And if you were their couples counselor, if you were Jane and John's couple counselor, what advice would you give them? Like, what do you think went wrong in their marriage? Because obviously, it's not the like the damage starts being done, I think, before the affair. Tell me what you think about that.
Yeah, I think what I would probably tell Jane is there's something about their situation where John is not feeling seen in a way that I think he needs to be seen or desires to be seen. And then for John, you know, I think it's the same thing. Like, I think Jane is doing things she thinks are building her marriage. She's task focused and, you know, just accomplishing her list of things they need to do. And that's what she thinks showing love is. And I think John is in a different place and needs to recognize that what she's doing is, in fact, maybe seeing him in a way he doesn't recognize as him being seen. But I think it's easy to take spouses for granted generally. And when you look at a lot of people with tension in their marriages, maybe not this extreme, you know, it really comes down to just maybe taking a second and thinking about, you know, who is my spouse now? How can I see them now? And I feel like maybe that was somewhat at the root of their struggle, John and Jane's struggle.
Yes, yes. Oh, that's a great answer. Your next career, couples counselor. The book is really suspenseful, which I'm very, I'm always really impressed by writers of, I mean, this is a thriller, but like you said, it's also literary fiction. It's just a really beautiful book, and I don't know how you did any of it, but how did you do the suspense? Like, how did you know what clues to reveal at what time? Did you struggle with that? Did that take a lot of revising or a lot of like advice from your editor, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah. So I will start by saying that my editor, Dan Lopez at Counterpoint, was fantastic and very much gave me some very helpful advice. And we did do a couple of tweaks to certain clues and pacing things, but most of it was, I think there at the beginning, they were pretty minor tweaks, and I accomplished that mainly by what I told you earlier, which is I wrote most of the book without knowing. And so for me, it was just the natural evolution of, I need to keep putting things in, you know, as a super technical matter. Okay, who are the red herrings? And yeah, all of, and I didn't look at it like that because they were all potential suspects, right? So as the siblings are conducting their investigation 30 years later, they're naturally finding clues. And I had to, you know, the way I wrote it was basically at some point in my mind, I will hit a point when the clues will add up to definitively rule one person in and one, you know, another out, per se, you know. And so that's kind of how I did it. And it just naturally kind of fell into, I think I got lucky. But I followed some good rules, right? I didn't want to surprise the reader. It wasn't, I needed to make it fair. And that was easy because I didn't know the answer. So it's not like I could withhold information until the end and then suddenly spring a final clue on somebody that they couldn't have figured it out.
Right, right. Or a character that all of a sudden appears on page 300.
Exactly. And so there are leads. And I think, you know, it, talking to people who have read it, some people guess it very early and some people don't. And maybe that's luck. Maybe they're very good. But it's, you know, I think the suspense of even the people who think they guess it very early, I don't know that they know for certain, because I certainly don't.
Yeah, oh, that's great. I saw that you went to the Tisch School. You studied performance as an undergrad. I know that was probably a long time ago, but does that ever come into your writing? Do you ever fall back on that education when you're writing?
Oh, absolutely. I think both in terms of understanding, you know, drama and dramatic layouts and how to analyze, you know, a text, I definitely use that training a lot. The other way I use it is in dialogue. I will often, as I'm writing a scene, think about what each character wants in the scene. How are they going to get what they want? What tools will they use to get what they want? And so I almost kind of imagine an acting exercise sometimes on paper. And then same thing, right? It's the idea that whatever the spoken line is might not actually be what the character wants or is trying to communicate. And so how does that play out? And so I try to work all of that in there. And then the third thing is, like I said, like
I try to really get into the characters' minds. I'm not a method actor in the sense of Daniel Day-Lewis, where I start pretending I'm Abraham Lincoln or anything like that. But I very much do try to get in the character's head to think about, how is this character going to behave? What do they want? What's the context of where they're standing there? And, try to bring that to the text.
No, that's cool. That's like a good writing tip, actually. And now this is just a very practical question, because my friends who are lawyers work like a bajillion hours a week. So how did you fit in writing this novel? And I know you've written a whole bunch of other stuff too, but how do you manage that while you're working as a lawyer?
I am blessed with one, I don't want to say insomnia, because it's not that. I sleep very well when I sleep. I just don't like to sleep. I feel like I'm missing things, so I'm always trying to just keep myself occupied. But seriously, my kids were a little older when I started writing this book, so the young child care, pressures, time pressures were not as present. I don't watch that much TV or waste that much time in terms of doom scrolling on the internet or other things people, including me, might find themselves doing from time to time. I really do try to just stay productive. And then the third thing is, I'm just blessed that when I actually sit down to work, I work pretty fast. But that said, this book took me a lot, this was a long project to write. So it took me 3 or 4 years, I think, from when I put the pen to paper and when I completed the first draft.
Yeah. Well, very impressive. And we are unfortunately running out of time. Is there anything else that you'd like to discuss about this book that we haven't touched on?
I think one thing I would touch on is I really do try to write and subscribe to the theory that once it's on paper, it's the reader's book too. And I've been I've done a couple of book club appearances in New York City where people ask me questions about, what did you mean or what did you intend when you did X or Y or Z in the book? And my answer is always well, what do you think it means? What your interpretations of the ballad is mine. Whatever was in my head that didn't make it to the page is just in my head. It's kind of headcanon, as they call it, right? So I can tell you about that, but I'm more interested in what you think, because that's really where that's where being a reader is fun, right? And so I just think one of the fun things, I think, as people read the book is, to the extent it's on the page and you think you have a theory or you think the book means something to you, that's the part where I find it rewarding to hear about later or see when online or whatever. So that part's fun. So I'd encourage people to read all their books with the idea that being a reader is just as valid as being a writer.
Oh, that's great. I love that. Yeah. And I know I often hear writers on this show say that they didn't even know they were doing something until a reader told them they were doing it in the book.
Precisely.
Yeah. So that's great. All right. Well, that was Victor Sutamanon, the author of Hollow Spaces. Victor, thank you so much for joining us on the Gulf Coast Life Book Club.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Buy the book from Macintosh Books through bookshop.org, and we will have the links at wgcu.org. Thank you for listening to the Gulf Coast Life Book Club. I'm your host, Carrie Barber. We had production help today from Mike Canary. This is WGCU-FM, Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.